Can you tell me a story?
Sure. Once upon a time, a mom needed a new car.
Was she brave?
She was tired, mostly. But she went to Carvana.com and found a great car at a great price. No secret treasure map required.
Did she have to fight a dragon?
Nope. She bought it 100% online. From her bed, actually.
Was it scary?
Honey, it was as unscary as car buying could be.
Did the car have a sunroof?
It did, actually.
Okay, good story.
Car buying you'll want to tell stories about. Buy your car today on
Carvana.
Delivery fees may apply.
What did the Vikings call themselves?
Are skirt and shirt the same word?
And which place names come from Old Norse?
Today we are ransacking our way through history to find out about the grammar and vocabulary the Vikings brought to English in this episode of Words Unraveled.
Welcome to another Words Unraveled. I'm Rob Watts from the YouTube channel Rob Words.
And I'm Jessa Ferris, author of etymology books, including Useless Etymology. And today we are talking about Viking and Old Norse words in English, which we have a surprising amount of. Would you care to recap why we have so many Old Norse words in English?
It's interesting we refer to them as Viking words because it is through encounters between the Vikings, and we'll go into exactly who the Vikings were, and the English that result in us getting all of these words. And there are a couple of ways that it happens. You have sort of Norwegian Vikings, if you can divide them up into Norwegian and Danish, you sort of try to anyway. They arrive first to the British Isles, and they sort of head over the top, and they have a big influence in Scotland and over in Ireland and along the sort of west of Britain. And it's the Danes who later terrorize the English coast before moving inland to snatch some land for themselves. And they do so very successfully. And this is all happening in the sort of 9th, 10th centuries, bit in the 8th century as well. And they end up with a huge chunk of England called the Danelaw, where you have Old Norse speakers, the language of the Vikings, and Old English speakers, the language of the Anglo-Saxons, and they're hanging out, they're marrying one another as well as fighting, and the languages start to intermingle, and the vocabulary starts to intermingle. And that's a very potted history, but we'll definitely get into more of it as we go along.
So I would love to talk about the word Viking, because the word Viking was basically not used in English for the Vikings or for Scandinavian seafarers of any kind until the early 1800s. Did you know this?
I didn't know this. Are you sure?
reasonably, yes. So it was revived in Sharon Turner's multi-volume, The History of the Anglo-Saxons, which was published between 1799 and 1805. And it's this big foundational romantic era text that pioneered the study of Old English literature and established the modern Anglo-Saxon historical scholarship. And you've covered it before to an extent, but in Old Norse, the word vikingr meant freebooter, sea rover, or sea voyager, or pirate, and it's typically explained as meaning someone who came from the fjords. The word vik meant creek or inlet or small bay. Some scholars in the early 1800s also posited that the king in Viking was related to the word king, which would make them vik kings or kings of the bay, but that's been discredited.
Yeah, it's not that.
So the idea here is that these seafaring raiders of the early Middle Ages did not refer to themselves collectively as Vikings, right? Viking wasn't an ethnic identity. It was a job description.
Profession.
Yeah.
if you're still in Scandinavia, you're probably not a Viking at the moment.
Right.
You're a Viking when you set off, which is why we do talk about them still being Vikings, because the people that do arrive and maraud in England are Vikings because they have done this venturing.
If you were among the people who were doing the seafaring, you identified yourself by your specific tribe or region or kingdom, and the Anglo-Saxons, as you noted, called the Vikings the Danes, but that was also kind of reductive too, because they weren't all necessarily calling themselves the Danes. But there was a similar Old English word, weeking, which is what you've kind of alluded to, which is recorded centuries before the first instance of the Old Norse word vikingr, and it is thought to be from a word wick or witch, meaning village or camp. So it could be that's also one that appears in lots of place names, and it's been a subject of debate whether the wicks or the vicks are related.
Why would they be called camp people? Because what they used to do
yes.
was they would arrive in the summer And then they would camp through the winter somewhere, sporadically irritating the local people. But that Vik from Old Norse is in Reykjavik. I don't know if we mentioned this before, which means like smoky bay. Also Scotland, Wick is a place there, and that's thought to probably be from the Viking, the Old Norse word for a bay, rather than the Anglo-Saxon word, which there's no reason it would be an Anglo-Saxon word, because the Anglo-Saxons are not in Scotland, are they, by definition, pretty much.
This collection of people that were called the Danes in Anglo-Saxon weren't typically called the Vikings until the 1800s.
Yeah, they got called Norsemen as well. Danes. And they use Danes to refer to anyone that's speaking a Scandinavian tongue.
Often when you find information about this, it'll say it's from a Scandinavian source, which means it's an Old Norse-derived word that has come through a more specific language.
We have absolutely loads of those, because during that period where the two languages were rubbing up against one another, the English language changed enormously. It's hard to know which changes we can attribute specifically to the influence of Old Norse, because not long afterwards, you also get the Normans coming, and English literature sort of disappears a little bit because it gets overtaken by French literature. There's this sort of dark period, and then Middle English emerges from what was once Old English, and it's so different to Old English. We're not 100% sure why all of the differences are there. They could be because of the Normans, they could just be because of time, or they could be because the Vikings language has changed it. Also, the loss of grammatical gender, because Old English had masculine, feminine, and neuter, and that disappears around the time that the Vikings, the Danes, I should say Danes, are hanging out in England. It just goes. And they've got their own grammatical gender thing going on. But one of the theories is that the grammatical genders between Old English and Old Norse didn't match up for the same object. So they just kind of called the thing off, or they simplified their speech so that they could communicate with one another, and grammatical gender just made it too complicated. But we do get our most sort of gender-aware pronouns from the Vikings, which is kind of funny, because the pronouns, they, their, and them, come from Old Norse. Before that, in Old English, we were using hier, him, and hiera for they, them, and their. So imagine trying to use him as the non-binary pronoun now. It wouldn't be as simple as using them. There's some really key verbs that we have now that we didn't have in Old English. For example, the word take replaced the Old English niman. So we got that from the Vikings. And the word are, when we say you are, they are, that are is from the Scandinavian languages. And it replaced Old English bist and beoth. So you was with bist rather than are, and they, beoth, is now with R instead.
Seem is another one. Seem is a bit odd because it's this mercurial concept, meaning to appear or perceive to be in Old English, and that's from Old Norse. And in Old Norse, the preceding word seema meant to honor or to conform to. There was an adjective form meaning fitting. So the Old Norse honor sense seems to be based on the notion of granting someone the fame they've earned or the fame that befits them. And when it first crossed into Middle English, it meant to be fitting or to be appropriate. So if you said hit seemeth or it seems, you would mean that it appears to be so. And over the centuries, fitting evolved into this modern sense of giving a certain impression or appearing to be. And we still sort of get the same connection to the earlier sense with the word seemly, though I don't know that many people use that word that much anymore, but it means decorous or becoming or proper or fitting or decent. And the root here might mean one or as one, suggesting that appearances or honors or expectations are one with the truth or the way things befit other things.
It's almost a lost positive, isn't it, seemly?
Yeah.
And we talk about things being unseemly, but we don't talk about them being seemly. Right. Anymore. You also get doublets as well. We borrow verbs from the Vikings that are very similar to verbs that we've already got. For example, we have to bath or to bathe, which is from Old English, and we get to bask, which is what we'd call a cognate. Talk about cognates before, but basically a word with ultimately the same Germanic origin. that we end up borrowing again and giving it a slightly sort of different sense.
Another interesting thing that we got on the grammatical side that I think we've brought up before in our unpaired words episode is the word ruthless. You know, we have the word rue and we have ruthless. We can say you'll rue the day, or you can say that someone is ruthless, but we don't really use ruth as a noun. A ruthless person, you know, doesn't regret their actions no matter how awful. And it's from an Old Norse word meaning sorrow. So to be hryger was the original word, meant to be sorrowful or grieved. The notion of ruing the day is you'll feel sorrow about the word. Now, rue and ruth share a root, but they may have entered English separately, rue being the older word and then appearing in Old English, and then ruth from Old Norse and appearing in the 1200s. And then they melded together, modeled after the pairing of the adjective true with the noun truth. So we kind of tacked on this other Old English ending, which is very fun. And also it's unrelated to the name Ruth.
Yeah. We sort of diverted away from the grammar. I think that was my fault because I start going to vocabulary again. But I was looking up sort of whether the Scandinavian languages order their words a bit more like us than our closer relatives, which are the other West Germanic languages like Dutch and German. So German is more closely related to English than Swedish, Norwegian, Danish, technically. But those other three, which are all descendants of Old Norse, may have a lot of things in common with English because Old Norse influenced English. And I thought maybe word order would be one of those things. So maybe we can just judge that, because I was looking up, there's a very good website you can go to for looking up Old English grammar. And it gives an example of the sentence, which is in three parts, but it's a good sentence for showing off how word order works. The sentence is, the Viking went to his ship, which was in the Thames estuary, and then he traveled to London. So it includes the Old English, which I'm not going to read out because it sounds terrible when I try to read Old English. What is it? Se Viking gjorde to his shipper. Yeah, anyway, I won't embarrass myself by doing the whole thing. But in Old English, the order of the words becomes the Viking went to his ship. So that's how we have it now. But then for that clause in the middle, that on Thames estuary was. So the verb has gone to the end of it, whereas we wouldn't have put it there. Whereas in Swedish, so a descendant of Old Norse, the order of the words is which was on the Thames estuary, which is the same as how we do it.
Ah!
Isn't that interesting?
That is so interesting.
Yeah. Whereas the German would be that in the Thames estuary was. So we're actually closer to the Swedish word order there.
Ooh.
Than to the German word order. I know that's an isolated case. And it's because in the Scandinavian languages, they're called V2 languages, which means the verb always comes second, but not necessarily in subordinate clauses. Anyway, point is, our word order changes around the time the Danes are there to be more like what the modern Scandinavian languages are like. So I'm just doing a bit of investigation there and thinking maybe Old Norse influences the English word order to make it more like, you know, the Old Norse than like our more traditional pals.
That makes perfect sense to me. And that would also make sense. Correct me if I'm wrong, but the Vikings also partially became and influenced the Normans as well, right?
Well, the Normans were Vikings. Yeah, that's worth mentioning, isn't it? We should mention
that. Yeah, so like that, it's coming from two directions.
Yeah, it's true. Yeah. So Rollo, one of the most famous Vikings, you know, Norse warlord, he lands in northern France. He manages to bully the name of the ruler, the local ruler that he bullies is something really funny. His name was King Charles the Simple. And anyway, he's so worked up by these Vikings that are hanging around that he gives them a bit of northern France. And that place gets known as Normandy after the Normans.
Yeah.
The word Norman meaning Norsemen, Northmen.
There we go. Glad I'm not pulling that completely out of my ass.
It's true. So William the Conqueror is a descendant of the Vikings. So in 1066, you have Harold Godwinson, the Anglo-Saxon, the king of England at the time, heading up north to fight Harald Hardrada, who is, to all intents and purposes, a Viking. He's a Scandinavian king. And then Harold defeats him. So Harald Godwinson defeats Harald Hardrada, then heads down south. And we like to think to go and fight a French guy. But really, he goes down south to fight a French guy who's really quite Viking as well. So it's really quite... It's more of a Germanic face-off than you might think.
Right.
The Battle of Hastings, that is.
I am reminded, as far as like grammatical elements go, I already brought up fossil words, but we still get sort of vestiges of prepositions and things in English as well, from in modern English, from Old Norse, like fro, as in to and fro. Fro was a preposition, an adverb meaning away or backward, and it's originally found in Northern English and Scottish dialects, but it's from the Old Norse fra, meaning from, and it's basically a doublet of from in English because Old English already had one. And I've mentioned this, I think, to death, but ado is also a vestige of an Old Norse infinitive. You know, in English, we pair unconjugated verbs with the word to create the infinitive form, to go, to walk, to speak, to create, to podcast, etc.
Oh, dear. Yes.
But English also has some influence from Old Norse, as we know. And an example of why that works with the word ado is you can kind of look at Norwegian, which is a modern Nordic language, and Norwegian infinitives are typically produced by the particle that which is cognate with the word at. So if there were a little more influence from Old Norse, then our modern infinitive particle could very well have ended up being at rather than to. So instead of to speak or to walk or to podcast, we could at speak or at podcast. And that's basically what happened with the word ado, which is a contraction of at and do, and it means a big deal or a big commotion in the same way that a big to-do means a big commotion in English as well.
Funnily enough, we do sort of do that when we say, I'm going a-hunting.
Yeah.
That's at hunting, isn't it?
Uh-huh.
Ultimately. Uh-huh. When I'm going uh-huh, that's at-ha. No, not really. Also the preposition till, that one's from Old Norse. So we have to, which is from Old English, and till, which is from Old Norse. And we somehow managed to find different uses for them. You know, I'm going to be here till Wednesday. I'm going to be here to Wednesday doesn't work. But ultimately, they're serving the same purpose.
It's interesting that until is from till, even though we sort of think of till as being a shortening of until.
Yeah, you're right. I might even sometimes write it with an apostrophe now I think about it. Isn't that funny?
It sounds lazier, but it's the original word.
That's really good. Oh, I love this stuff.
And it's the Old Norse und, meaning as far as or up to, and then the till element as well as the preposition, which is fun.
It's quite a lot of fun to be had with the doublets, actually. I mentioned bask and bathe as well. But you get like K words in English. A lot of the time the Normans are responsible for them in some way, because in Old English, these sounds are spelt with a C, and particularly like sk words were pronounced sh because it's about sc and it was a sh sound. So words like sky, skin, skill, skirt, they're all from Old Norse, but skirt and shirt are just the Old English and the Old Norse equivalents of the same word, and they mean a short garment, and the word short is therefore also related to short shirt and skirt. So there's three garments that have the same etymology ultimately, which is pretty cool. But we get skin from Old Norse. Old English is hide instead. So it's not the same word.
Yeah, you know,
it's a different word that we've bothered in that case. And skill, the Old English equivalent would be craft, which we still use. Another one that's not related, but it's dyke and ditch as well. They're
a good
doublet. Mm-hmm. Dyke is from Old Norse and ditch is from Old English. And they ultimately mean the same thing, don't they? They mean an hole in the ground. But we've managed to somehow accommodate both words.
Scar is an interesting one because the the post-injury word scar is from the old French escar, meaning scab, which is from a Latin and Greek word like eschara and escara. And in Greek, it was specifically a word for a scab that forms after a burn, like an actively healing wound, which is not quite what scar means in modern English. It's more of a healed wound that still has a sign behind it. The English word is probably altered by the Old Norse skarð, meaning a crack or a cut or an incision, which is related to the word score, as in to scratch something, like scoring something, which is also why we use score for counting things and whatnot, because you scrape your little tallies onto stuff. But in Old Norse, it usually referred to scratches in rocks. It could be like a visible scratch in a rock or a topographical rift in a rock. And we also see that in 14th to 17th century in English, because scar is still sometimes found in place names and the names of rock formations and whatnot, because it was a word for a bare or broken rocky face or a cliff from the side of a mountain, as well as like detached craggy outcroppings and things too. So like a scar in the earth isn't necessarily, in some cases it is like the remnants of a river or something on the landscape, but in many cases it is also a big craggy something.
It's making me think of the Scarfell Pike, the largest hill/mountain in England, because both of those elements, scar and fell, have got a Scandi ring to them, right? Except what's a fell? A fell is a hill, isn't it? So I wonder if it means craggy hill. Oh, I've got to look that up now.
Yeah, we got to find out.
Yes.
Yes.
It's from Old Norse.
Excellent.
Hooray.
Hooray, we did it.
Yeah, you gave me something nice there. Thanks, Jess.
We have a number of other topographical words from Old Norse as well, like cliff and gap. Like every sense of the word gap is from a topographical gap from Old Norse.
The gap as well?
Yeah, every kind of gap. Well, I don't actually know why the store is called The Gap. We should find that out. I would assume it's a capitalized, so it might be an acronym. Anyway, cliff is an Old Norse word. And then gap in Old Norse is a word for an opening or a void, including like mythical gaps and things. In Norse mythology, the Ginnunga gap, I think is how you say that, is the gaping void or the yawning abyss, which is a primordial gap that lies between the icy northern realm of Niflheim and the fiery southern realm of Muspelheim. Huh. Every gap came from big, scary, mythical gaps and voids.
I mean, we should talk about the fact that we do associate the Vikings with violence, and they do kind of deliver insofar as we do have quite a lot of violent words that do come from the Vikings. Violent Viking vocab.
Many unpleasantries and crimey words.
Words like berserk, you know, the supposed bearskin warriors that used to take to the battlefield dressed in bearskin to go absolutely ape. Shh. Can I say ape? Martin, did you beat that, Martin?
You.
but also slaughter is from Old Norse, which is highly appropriate. Ransack from Old Norse. Club, the weapon. Knife is thought to be influenced by Old Norse as well. So they did. They, you know, there are some brutal words, but then we have some very unbrutal words like egg.
Egg. I want to drag us back to berserk for a second, because Walter Scott kind of gave that one back to us in modern English, and he backformed it accidentally. Like the Old Norse word is berserker, and it has the R on the end, and then berserk is sort of a clipping of it. And he thought it meant bare or naked, so he thought they were like rushing into battle naked, which maybe they were, but it is probably the opposite of that. It probably means bear shirt, so a warrior clothed in bear skin, not in bear skin.
Yeah. Yeah, it's unfortunate that we've got those homophones even now, but that shouldn't be catching you out if you're doing etymology, surely.
Right. But the berserkers would also ransack, which is a word we have from Old Norse, ran being a word for a house, and saka meaning a word for to seek. So you're literally searching a house, originally like legally for stolen goods, but then also in pillagey ways.
Husband as well is a word that we get from Old Norse. Well, we're talking about houses,
the because houseman.
that means bound to the house. Essentially, it means the head of the household, usually a man, doesn't necessarily have to be.
The older English word for that being were, which has come up before and survives in werewolf. Were and weef was men and woman.
And you also had quain, which would be a wife, as we now think of it, the
queen,
the woman of the household, from which we get queen. Yeah, exactly. That's nice, isn't it? But that's not Old Norse. I think that's old English.
The word anger is influenced by Old Norse. In late Old English, when it was introduced from Old Norse, anger was a transitive verb, like we use it in today in a sentence, like the principal angered her or something like that, the principal of the situation. Though in Old Norse, it had a noun form, anger, and then the verb form, angra. And I'm getting to something here. The English word anger and the Old Norse angra originally meant to irritate or annoy or vex or distress or provoke in both Old Norse and Old English. But Old Norse also had some interesting words like angerless, essentially, and angerlindi, meaning a sadness or low spirits, and anger became a noun about a century after it entered English as a transitive verb. And it also has a slightly different sense compared to today. It also covered a general, like, hostile attitude, but it meant ill will or surliness. And then it was also a word for physical pain around this time too. It did a lot of work, which I guess we sort of get that sense when we say that an injury looks angry. But Middle English had the word anger.
Do we say that?
I
never thought, I have heard that. I've always kind of thought of it as being someone being a bit cute, but maybe, I guess they're not. I guess it isn't that. I've just thought of someone being figurative, but maybe it isn't. Maybe it's just a straight up use of the word angry.
A neat thing here is that the Proto-Germanic and Proto-Indo-European roots of anger and all of these words that I've mentioned means tight or painfully constricted or narrow, and are thus related to the word hangnail, which, as we've discussed, originally didn't have anything to do with hanging, but whose first element was ang or ag, meaning painful. And it's related to the word angst.
Ah, right. Angst being the German word for fear that we've borrowed.
Yes.
And there's also the ultimate violence, which is death, our verb to die.
Die,
comes from,
yes,
Old Norse. You know, people who watch a lot of my videos will be bored to death of me pointing this out. But before that, we were using a word. So the German for to die is sterben. And we had a similar word to that in Old English. That word today is starve. So we use it to describe dying a specific way through lack of food. But perhaps if the Vikings hadn't given us the verb die, we would still be talking about starving, meaning to die. So you wouldn't starve to death, you would just starve, and by implication would be dead.
Old English also had forfahren, meaning to fare forth, which was obviously more euphemistic. And then I have also read that Old English is thought to have also had a word related to die as well, but it's not found in any surviving texts. And it could be that you avoided saying it in the same way that you avoided saying, like, the name of a bear.
Bear.
Right?
I love these. Yeah, let's reiterate that one as well. We think bear just means brown thing. We don't know.
Yeah.
We don't know what the original word for bear was, because we think everyone's just using euphemistic words for bear across Europe because of some overarching superstition about the name for it.
The word that is now swelter was also sometimes used for dying in Old English, but probably like dying of a fever. The idea being like it means to burn slowly. So you're slowly overcome with either like the heat of the sun or a fever. And then there was also forthgan, meaning gone forth. You have gone forth, therefore you are dead.
Yeah. Okay. So that's essentially the same as, what was it? Fortfahren?
Fortfahren. Oh, forthfahren was go forth, but then there was also forthgan, which is the same thing as like gone forth.
Well, they differentiate between this sort of fahren and go in German. They both mean go. We would use go for both of those, but one of them is sort of being, is traveling by some means to get there, which is the sort of fahren in German. And gehen, which is their equivalent of go, is doing it on foot. So maybe in Old English, I don't know, I'd have to double check this. One of them is more the idea of being delivered forth, and the other one is more the idea of strolling there yourself.
We also have that foreign bit in, like, how do you fare?
There we go. Farewell.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. You know, actually, in a few episodes ago, we asked that exact question. We said, where are there like versions of that word in English? And you've just...
Hey, we found them.
There we go.
Old English also had waesan dead, which literally just means they are dead, which sounds very un-euphemistic now, but evidently it was less so in the past. It's often found in association with like still water or air.
Yeah, I think that's become dead essentially, isn't it? So yeah. So we've got the word dead, but it's just the verb die that is lacking.
Ill is also from Old Norse. It's not that interesting. It meant morally evil, not physically ill as we do now.
We have a kind of transatlantic difference here, don't we, between sick and ill? Because I feel like you're more likely to say sick in the States and we're more likely to describe ourselves as ill.
But you still talk about illnesses with, I think, a similar 100%. Frequency.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, we absolutely do. You know, if I looked at the words ill and sick, I would have guessed that sick was the one from Old Norse because it's got that k thing that I was talking about. It's even got a s in there, but no, it's all the way around.
By the way, while we're on it, when a word like ill or sick becomes slang for something very cool or good, it's sometimes called an inversion. And this is an example of one of those.
Like bad. Man, this is bad. This podcast is really bad. It's very bad. Having a bad time.
That's all right. We could be having an ugly time, which is also from Old Norse.
Oh, very good.
Ugly is fun. It looks like it has an adverbial ending, and it kind of does. It's from the Old Norse ugligur, which means inspiring dread or dreadful or dread-like, with that ligur ending meaning like. And the second component of the Old Norse word is cognate with the English ly ending, which is from the English ending lik, meaning like. Ugly is a little bit of an unusual word for unpleasant looks because most of them in most languages are not based on words meaning fear or dread, but rather compounds meaning ill-shaped or deformed, essentially. So that makes ugly especially insulting because it implies an appearance so horrendous that it strikes fear into others.
Oh, dear. We are using it rather more casually than it's used historically, aren't we?
The word ugly
now. It's less of an insult in the past, more of a sort of awe-inspired dread. Yeah.
Wrong also has softened somewhat. I mean, well, I don't know. It went through an interesting journey. It's from Old Norse. It's from the word rangr, meaning crooked or awry. And originally it's from a root meaning like curved. So in English, it evolved from physically bent or twisted to unjust or morally incorrect. But it does, interestingly, make sense as the opposite of the word right, as in right and wrong, which is related to the Latin rectus, meaning straight. So you got crooked and straight, right and wrong, which is kind of fun.
That's very good.
It's also related to words like rye and awry, as well as warp and rap and wrath, which is, as we know, a word for intense fury and the sin of rage, but it is also the usual Old English word for, the other word we got from Old Norse, which is anger.
I don't wish to naysay, but the word nay is also thought to be from Old Norse. We've got Old English no and Old Norse nay. It does fit with the modern Scandinavian languages. You want to say no in Swedish, you say nay.
That one's a compound word too, which is fun.
Nay is.
Yeah, the Old Norse nay is a compound of not and the word for ever. So it literally means not ever.
Oh, right, like knee in German. Now, yeah, okay. That is the thing, isn't it? You put N at the start of something to just make it the negative version of it. We do it with never and ever.
No. No is also a compound.
No and O?
Yeah. The ah at the end of it was in Old English, it was N-A was the word, and it's the word for not was N-E, and then the ah meant ever.
I don't know if it's ultimately an abbreviation of not in these senses, like not ever, never. No one, not one. None, not one. Probably not. None, not one.
I have a silly thing that happened with an Old Norse word, and it's Shakespeare's fault, but not really.
Go on.
So grovel is an Old Norse word, but it shouldn't have an L on it.
I do know that grovel is a back formation from a longer word.
So Shakespeare's often credited with coining the word grovel in Henry VI, I think. But what he actually did was he backformed groveling, which was used in Middle English exclusively as an adjective, as in phrases like with groveling countenance or a groveling swine. But that's a misunderstanding of the word, which was originally an adverb, and it's because of the ending on it. It's ultimately from an Old Norse word whose part of speech was misunderstood. The root is the Old Norse word gruva, which means to be prone. And it's found mostly in idiomatic phrases like licha agruvu, meaning lie face down, or literally lie on proneness. And it entered Middle English paired with the adverbial suffix ling, which is an Old English ending. So in Middle English, we have the adverb gruveling, but that ending is the same as the ending long in like sidelong, which is in Middle English was sidling, and headlong, which in Middle English was headling. And it isn't related to the words long or along, but it was just a way to make these words into a directional adverb. So headlong originally and literally meant doing something headily or head first. Right. And sidelong meant like looks like it should mean along the side, but more literally means sidely or directed at. And groveling as an adjective, sorry, just getting back to the point.
I love it. Keep going.
Groveling as an adjective originally meant prone-like or sideways, grove-long, essentially, grovelong. But of course, it was misinterpreted as being a participle ending in ing, which means the L was incorrectly re-bracketed onto grovel on that assumption.
That has taken me quite aback. It has taken me arse-long, indeed. Arse-long is an actual one of those. Headlong, arse-long. You lost that one. Bring it back.
Oh, another grammar quirk that came from Old Norse, the comparative ending more added to already comparative adjectives like innermore and outermore and furthermore is also in Old Norse. It's thought to be from Scandinavian as far as our modern usage of it is, but it may be a little bit older.
Do you want to talk a bit about place names?
Yes.
These are very present relics of Old Norse, ones that haven't necessarily been distorted quite so much by, you know, usage in day-to-day language. Place names obviously do change over time, but I'm from the city of Derby, and the B at the end of there, that is an Old Norse suffix because Derby was in the Danelaw. So places like Grimsby as well, that was also in the Danelaw, they have this same Old Norse settlement suffix at the end of there. Derby means place of the beast or place of the deer. We talked about how the word deer meant more generally a beast, an animal.
Wilderness is the wilderness, the place where the beasts are.
Yeah, indeed. And actually the island of Jura as well in Scotland, if you know your whiskey, you know that. That's essentially island of the beast. The start of that is the same thing. But also places then with Thorpe as well have got Old Norse endings. So Scunthorpe again is in the old Danelaw. Places then with Thwaite and Kirk. So there'll be places in America that have these in their names, presumably named after usually British places or British people who are named after British places or people who are named after British places. Anyway, so I'm hoping this isn't too specific, but that's just in sort of England where you've got that Danish influence. If you look at a lot of the islands around Britain, a lot of them end with EY, which means island in Old Norse. So you have Orkney, which I am going to next week with Martin, the editor. I'm going to go and try and find out more about the language that they used to speak there, which is called Norn, spoken on Shetland and Orkney, which are actually also island groups themselves. Norn was I suppose you could call it a variety of Norwegian. So it's a Scandinavian language, one of the British Isles, as we call them. It's very hard to know what to call them, actually, because the Irish don't like you calling them the British Isles. But anyway, for ease, where they're speaking a Scandinavian language. And that language only dies out in the mid-1800s, which is incredible. So I'm going to go and find out more about that. But Orkney itself, O-R-K-N-E-Y, is thought to come from the Old Norse for sea islands.
Ooh.
And then there's an important place where Martin and I are going to be staying, well, at least flying into, because it's where the airport is, called Kirkwall. We've already talked about Kirk being the Old Norse for church. So that means church inlet. And then the name Norn, the language, means Northern. Mm-hmm. So it's the Northern Scandinavian language, although we now think of those languages that were called Norn as Western Scandinavian. That's got very geeky. That's got very, very geeky there.
Oh, I like it.
But also Jersey and Guernsey, which are the opposite end. They're below England. Also, they're thought to be named after Vikings. They've got A at the end of the island. We don't know the exact names of those Vikings, but Jersey and Guernsey are thought to be named after them. And then there's Anglesey as well, which is an island just off Wales. We don't know what the angle bit means in that, but we do know that it's an island. yeah, and Skye, one of the Hebrides, so the Norwegians got over the top.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, again, mm-hmm. You get some nice whiskey there too. Means misty island, sort of just a just beautiful name, Isle of Skye.
Very romantic.
Yeah, it's lovely, isn't it? Even saying mm-hmm. Isle of Skye makes it sound yeah, right? like you're saying something nice. I love the sky. Sky being an mm-hmm. old Norse word, replacing heaven, which is the word that the Anglo-Saxons were using to describe the sky more generally.
Old Norse gave us haven, I believe.
Ah, and harbour as well, right? I mean, so heaven and haven aren't as linked as they seem like they should be.
Right.
Yeah, but haven and harbour, I believe, are. And if you think about it, they mean the same thing. They're just a place to settle down, get a bit of shelter.
Put your boat.
Pop your boat. Yeah, Copenhagen. The Hagen at the end of there is that same word. Yeah, just a few place names. People names as well. Some of those endure, particularly in Scotland, where some of the clans, so the Vikings, the Norwegians, whatever you want to call them, the Norsemen, settled there and set up their own clans. Clans in Scotland, particularly in sort of Western Scotland, they're family dynasties. Basically, the clan MacIver, for example, son of Ivar. Ivar
Ooh, being excellent.
A Norse name.
How
Macaulay,
cool.
Son of Olaf. Yeah.
So, excellent.
I mean, these are all around. They're really fun, aren't they?
Uh-huh, yeah. Never would have connected those.
No, you wouldn't, because they've got that Mac, that Mac.
Yeah, right.
So they're hybrid because that Mac comes from Gaelic languages, but the name that comes after the Mac, which means son of, comes from Old Norse, or if you call a name being from Old Norse, but certainly from Scandinavian names.
Well, thank you for that tour around place names. That was lovely.
Places and people still carrying the names of the Vikings who are long, long dead, who did die, who did get slaughtered, who did get ransacked with clubs and knives.
No. With that, we thank you for watching this episode of Words Unraveled, and we'll see you next time.
Take care.